Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have a delicious potluck recipe. Actually, we're going to have two potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Now, for this episode, we're going to discuss rejection. And, oh my, we already have lots of questions and lots of emails, and so we're going to go right into it. Good. Let's start with our first intro email, which is from Nathan. Thank you, Nathan. And he says, do you still get rejection when you ask people to participate in a community gathering? The short answer is yes, of course. I think that everyone gets rejection. I've been doing this a whole bunch of years, and, well, I suppose on a different show we'll discuss self-fulfilling prophecy, but I think it's a knee-jerk reaction from people. People don't like to discuss something that they're not sure about. They don't like to discuss or come to an event that might be slightly uncomfortable for them when they first start out. They're a little bit apprehensive. People don't like to give their time. And a lot of people will reject going to a community gathering, going to a potluck, going to a mediation, just automatically. They'll say, no, I don't want to. And that's just their first volley. And that's just your first volley. And Nathan has a follow-up question. He says, don't you get discouraged? And sometimes. But really, rejection is just part of the game. And you'll find that several of the participants that you really need might reject coming from the start, but we're going to practice working on them. And I have a whole bunch of emails here that ask me, basically, how do you get to yes? And the answer is, well, we're going to be persistent. We're going to say, how can I get these people? It's like herding cats, you know, the old expression. How can I get these people to want to come? Well, first of all, we're going to be very polite, aren't we? Because if we get irate or indignant or we annoy them, well, they're certainly not going to want to come. So we're going to be very polite. And we're going to start out with emails. We could start with some phone calls, if that is not too terribly intrusive. I sometimes think that phone calls are annoying. So emails might be a better choice. You can decide. It would be best if you didn't email everyone all at once, one of those kind of reply all type things, because it begins to get like spam. And people say, well, that's not personal to me. Somebody else will do it. So a personal email would be nice. And you can, of course, you can still use the same body of the email. Somebody's just asked me that. They said, do you use the same body to the email? And the answer is yes, why not? You don't have to recompose an email. You just change the name and send it to just that individual person so that it seems individual. We all know how to do that on a computer because we've done it before. But it will make it's like a cover letter to a resume. It will make it personal to that person, and they are more likely to respond. I have a follow-up question that asks, do we send the same email more than once to the same person, the same body of the email? The answer is that depends. I usually do not, because I assume that people do read their emails, and it becomes more like spam if you keep doing it. I wait a couple of days. People are busy. And remember that when you are trying to get a group together, you've got to give them enough time to respond. You can't say, well, we're going to get together, especially initially, maybe if it's an ongoing series of groups so that everyone knows when it is. But you can't just say, we're going to get together tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we need you to come. Well, no, because people's calendars are busy. And if people's calendars aren't busy, they'd like you to think their calendars are busy, and they're going to say, no, I can't schedule that close. So we're going to give people plenty of time to respond and to put it on their calendar. Unless it is an emergency. Yes, I see someone has asked me that. Sometimes you've got some sort of an emergency that has to be handled now, and we're going to talk about that later, but those kinds of things will probably not warrant an in-person meeting. You may have to video Skype that, because that may just be too complicated to get people to actually physically show up someplace for an emergency that is right now, this instant. So we're going to email. We're going to send several emails. We're going to do it personally, so that it's not just to everyone on the list, but to the individuals, because then you also won't get reply all when people argue with you and say, no, I can't, and like that. And then everybody else sees it because it was reply all, and then people don't think that they want to go to the party either, because possibly they're too busy too, you see. And we're going to try a telephone call. We might even perhaps see this person that we need to come and participate, and we might talk to them in a very nice manner and not be intrusive and like that. And people are telling me on their emails that they've done all these nice things, and the person who is the subject, the participant that you would like, either ignores you completely or has an assistant. Yes, I always love the assistant. The assistant say no, and it's not getting you anywhere. So what should we do? Oh, good. We have, Brian has said that the thing to do is have someone else invite them. And that is an absolute truth. Thank you for emailing that. The answer is yes, of course. One of the tricks of the trade, if we can call it that, is that sometimes the participant that you would like and is really necessary is, well, we'll just say a wee bit sick of hearing from you. So, or they would like to be invited by someone else. Well, that's always good, because someone else can say, well, I'm going, and it seems like a very good thing, and let's do it, you see? You get someone else to say, we're going to go, and we're going to do this, because it is a valid, wonderful idea, and we need to get together with the others, the other side, the other people even on our side, where there's some dissension. And we're going to get together, and we're going to talk about it. We're going to reach accord. We're going to come together. We might have a meal together, and we're going to see what can be done to reach our common good. Yes, sometimes the person, you have to think about who it is that you are inviting and how essential they are. Because sometimes the person is not that essential, and if other people are coming, they'll want to come too, and you can not be so excited about inviting them, because if you're getting a good group together, they will want to come. So you might hold off a smidge and see if you've got a really good group and people that they would like to network with, and they would be interested to talk to, then they would like to come. And they will come. You see? And I have a very interesting email from Marta. Thank you, Marta, who has said that you can prevent all of this. You don't have to do any of this if you get advanced preparation and have set some groundwork. And you know what? You have a very good point there. And Marta, would you be kind enough, I assume that you're listening, to email me back and tell me what type of group that you are dealing with. Thank you. It depends. It depends on your group. Sometimes you do not have to just email someone and say, come now, we're going to discuss this topic, this issue between the various parties. You might have laid some groundwork ahead of time. They might be anxious. They might come to you and say, you know, we would like to get together, and I know that you're a good mediator, you're a good host, and you would be a valuable addition to our group if you could come, if you could get us to get together, you see? And so that's always a valuable thought, too, that you could say, well, I am going to be of value. I am going to come, and you're going to have someone come to you. And Marta has responded, and she says that she is a family counselor. And that is the perfect type of group, because people who are family and need to have a resolution so that the family unit can continue, or if the family unit is, Marta says that she is a court-appointed family counselor in the case of domestic violence. So this is rather a specific case, of course, but Marta has people who must come before her because she's court-appointed. And this is groundwork in and of itself. So you've got advanced preparation, because you don't have to ask the people to come. They are coming, or else they will be in trouble in a legal manner. So thank you very much, Marta. That is a very good point. And yes, generally speaking, you can lay groundwork so that people don't run when you show up and you ask them things. And, well, here's a very interesting question from Diva. She says, what happens when they say yes, but they don't really mean it? Now we've gotten to the next point, haven't we? We've got someone who we've cajoled. We have laid groundwork. We have emailed them very politely. We have phone called them. We have gotten them to commit to a date. And they know about it. And, here's the next point before we get to Diva's question. The point, you must also, just before we get to the time of the meeting, we're going to send a confirmation. Yes, yes. And not the kind that goes with an Evite. You know how those things automatically, other programs too, they automatically send out a confirmation. And it has been my experience, and I've actually seen statistics. There's someone out there that counts this. But it has been my personal experience in particular that people ignore the automatic confirmations that come off of those things. They consider them spam. In fact, if you have a good enough security filter on your computer, they will be spam. You won't see them. So please send out your own confirmation. I actually have been known to hand write and snail mail a confirmation, a thank you for being willing to come. The date will be, and we're looking forward to seeing you, type note. It is time consuming, and it rather depends on the group and whether or not you think that will get the best response. So we have gotten someone to say yes, to commit to a date. We've gotten a whole group to say yes and to commit to a date. And we have confirmed just ahead of time. And they have either said, yes, I'm coming, or they've ignored it. There's a vast majority of people that don't actually confirm a confirmation. They don't necessarily reply. So here we get to Diva's question. What happens when you get a yes, but they don't really mean it? That happens a lot. And what happened? Here's Caroline, who has asked the next question. Is she says, I've had people say a confirmed yes, but when we get down to it, they don't come and they don't give an excuse. They don't call, they don't email, they just don't come. Well, my rule of thumb is, don't wait for them. Because you've got a whole group of people, and it looks, first of all, silly to sit around and wait for somebody to come, the great someone who may or may not show. If they show up late, that's wonderful. We'll all applaud. This is good. Late is fine. Hopefully not too terribly late. But we're not going to sit around and wait for them. And that's one of the reasons that I never give out a guest list. I never say who's going to come for sure, because life being what it is, I'm never quite know who's going to come for sure. We hope that everybody does. But, you know, sometimes people don't come. So don't wait for them. You can start without them. You might get further. They might not be as integral as you think they are. You might reach a chord between the people that are there. You might get pretty far. And even if not, you have introduced each other. You have, I know it's an overused word, but you have networked. You have broken bread together. You have shared some food. You have shared some ideas. You have already made inroads, set the groundwork. But if they do not come, do not get rude. Do not get all offended. It is your job as host. It is your job, hostess, but I call everybody host nowadays. There seems to be no actresses anymore either. There's only actors. It is your job to be calm and the impartial third party, so to speak. You are the person in charge, and it is your duty not to get rude, not to say anything rude about the person that didn't come while you're sitting there, and not to be rude afterwards. In fact, if the person that did not come needs to come next time, because they really are an important piece, I usually send them a lovely note telling them how much we missed them and that we had a wonderful good time without them and we got far, you see? And then they go, oh my goodness, I didn't come and things went ahead without me. Maybe, just maybe, I'm not as essential as I thought I was. I can't hold up the process personally. That's the key. No one individual should be allowed to hold up the process, because we are going to go forward. We are going to reach a common goal. We are going to reach a common good. And we're not going to let somebody keep us from doing so. Now, Georgia has asked an interesting question, and other people have asked it too. Pardon me. She wants to know, what if someone comes but doesn't bring any food or doesn't bring any money to chip into the common pot? Well, that's not a problem. It really isn't. I don't like to get it started, and they might be politely reminded in front of the group that everyone brought something delightful. We were looking forward to having you bring something that you love to eat. because if you get it started, then everyone will figure they don't have to bring it either, and they don't have to chip in the small amount of money that you've asked them to chip in for drinks or whatever it is that you've asked for. So you don't want to, it's somewhat contagious, so you don't want to get that started, but it is not fatal to the process, and the person will be invited to stay and reminded to bring next time. And if it was money, to bring money from this time and for next time. And in fact, depending on the group, if there is a small monetary chip in, a small monetary pot, sometimes the host or the person asks the person to see if someone can loan them the money. That's always embarrassing, isn't it? If someone has to give you the money in a very polite way, you'll remember to bring it next time. Because, well, everybody else did. But in any event, there will be enough food because you, as the host, will have made extra. There'll be plenty. And we have a corollary question right here. It says, Yetzi, Hu Ying has said, what if people refuse to bring information like papers and other statistical needs that they have been asked to bring in advance? So someone has become, or everyone has become unprepared because someone was supposed to bring a handout, or someone was supposed to do a presentation of information, and they have refused. They have not come with it. Well, you will find that although this is seems very strange, that sometimes that's just as good. Isn't that odd? But if you have pieces of paper or a PowerPoint, which I kind of discourage because it takes a lot of time, but sometimes people must do a PowerPoint, and you have a set presentation, people will oftentimes hide behind it. They will, if it is in their hand, look down at what's in their hand, look down at the information, and sit there and pretend to be studying it, so that they don't have to participate. That's why I don't, oftentimes, unless it is very, very necessary, I'm not that fond of a handout during a mediation, during a community get-together, during a consensus gathering, because it gives people an excuse to look down and be studious and seem like they are doing something, but really they are hiding. But if you needed it and they did not come, that's not a problem. Why is it not a problem? I've gotten all kinds of questions about how come and people are supposed to bring it and they are... I've gotten several questions that ask, should you require that the person get the information and come back, especially since a lot of information nowadays is on a computer and it wouldn't be that hard to do. That is a judgment call. Yes, and I see that people have done so. They have required, we have several people that have emailed in that says that you could all look at the computer screen. So if somebody's got a laptop. This is absolutely true. You certainly could, but I think sometimes, depending on the situation, it is just as good not to have information to look at in that sense and study, because I will assume that we are talking to a group that basically knows the facts, whatever they are. But you see that statement, knows the facts. People may know different facts. They may have a different perception of the information. They may have a different idea concerning it that won't come out if you are all looking at the same piece of paper, because that makes a uniform. It makes a the sameness. If you talk about it without having the information in front of you, you can find out perceptions. You can find out how people feel about something. You can find out what they think. You can find out if their facts are not your facts or not the other someone else's facts. Facts are funny little creatures. They might not all be identical. That may be one of the cores to whatever stands between us. One of the problems that is keeping us from reaching our common goal. We could have different perceptions. And that's a real good way to find out. You see, what you think is oftentimes more important than what's on a piece of paper or what's in a PowerPoint presentation or what's on the screen. Now, I've gotten a bunch of people objecting and saying, well, you need to look at the information and the facts in order to get an idea and a consensus. And this is absolutely true. But don't necessarily make it the be-all and end-all. We're trying to get together in a congenial atmosphere to reach a common goal and talk about what we need to do for the common good. So try to keep it a congenial atmosphere and not force information onto people. It will work out. Okay. Now, I have actually got a question here from Aaron that says, we have instances where participants become verbally and or physically abusive. How should this be handled? Yes, this is an interesting point. Thank you for emailing. And I see that we have quite a few yeses coming in because people have had that happen. Well, it depends on your group. I actually, if I think it is necessary, and if this is a judgment call, sometimes doing this is perceived to be rude. So you have to think about it from both ways and not just send things out by email or other means or tape them on the wall or something. You have to think about this. I do have a rule list that I can send out in advance. It's kind of a grammar school teacher rule list, I swear. It is, we will not raise our voices, we will not use profanity, that kind of a list. We will not hit, spit, or bite. And this, if it is a good idea to send it, and you have to think about it from the standpoint of the politeness and the socialness of the group and how far away they are and how much they truly dislike each other, or they are just having a dissension amongst people who truly know there's a common goal. So you could think about your list. I actually have students and I have people who have come up to me at seminars, and I have seen, and I understand people send me emails, that sometimes people have different types of groups that are using the Recipe for Peace Now concepts, and they are not necessarily adults. They use them with pre-adults, I like to call them. They use them with teenagers. I see several emails here that say that you've used it with children. The concepts go. But generally speaking, I usually talk about using it with adults and with teenagers, because children's a whole different ball of wax. You have to, it's got a different tenor. to the group because of their inexperience. And you're teaching them more than you are teaching adults and even teenagers. But I digress. The teenagers, if you do them on a regular basis, I have people who tell me that they have a rule that says, for example, no gang colors. Well, that's a very good rule, but that's not a rule that I would use unless I thought that that would be a problem. And so you can't have a list of rules. Pardon me. You can't have a list of rules that are general. You have to think about it and make it for the group. So we could have a rule list in advance. And I see lots of emails here that basically say that's nice. But if you've got what Aaron just said, that we have instances where participants become verbally and or physically abusive, how should this be handled? A rule list in advance is not going to do it. You know what? You're probably right. It will not do it, for the very simple reason is that if they're going to come surly, the rule list will probably not work. So what are we going to do? That's the question that everyone has asked. And the answer is, let's think about this for a moment. We have someone who is not only refusing to participate, who has rejected the process, but they have come surly. They have come truly nasty. And they are going to be a problem. Well, the first thing that I like to do is I'm in charge, right? Because I'm the host. But you've got a whole bunch of other people in the room. And generally speaking, the first reaction, hopefully, I guess, but this is what I have seen. The first reaction of the other people in the room when someone goes nasty is to be taken back, to be kind of appalled, to not think it's a really swell and dandy good thing. So what are we going to do when that reaction occurs and people kind of look around at each other to see the other people's reaction to this? Well, I think I should call it bad behavior. Someone has started to yell. Someone has used a profanity. We're going to try not to get to the part where they push. Yes, I saw the physically abusive. And yes, I see that some people have had we won't call it a fist fight, but I see that we've got some shoving matches that people have seen doing these kinds of mediations with groups that are truly, well, at least for the moment, think that they are not reaching common goal. People look to other people in the group to find out how they should react. That is your moment, at that instance, to make the reaction peer pressure, not to do that. Just like in preschool, when some little kid bites another little kid, the adult in charge, which is you, or maybe someone else. I mean, I'm assuming that you're the host, but there could be more than one host. Yes, I do that with some frequency. Or there could be a group, or everybody could have gotten together, and there's no particular host, but you're probably the most experienced. At that what should we do moment, before the group decides what to do, and God forbid decides that it's cool to do that, at that moment, we're going to intercede and we're going to use peer pressure. We're going to have everyone disapprove. You or the maybe more than one, that would be preferable, you and a co-host or you and somebody else that you can trust to have the same reaction, could say, no, we're not going to do that. This is a polite gathering. We're going to act like responsible adults. And we're not going to just get nasty. We will not start nasty, so we will not have it escalate. See, that's the problem. You want to be sure that you don't get escalation on something really, well, really not good like that. See? So we're going to use peer pressure. We're going to get the other people in the group at the instant that they're trying to decide what to do to take the side of we can't have that. And I see that I'm getting emails and people are saying, if that doesn't work, should we throw them out? Should we have someone throw them out? Should we have someone evict them? Well, I'm not there, and you are. And I know that I say this a lot, but it kind of depends. It is my absolute last resort. And please, 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 it should be your absolute last resort. The reason being is the purpose for the group meeting, the purpose that we have gotten together, the purpose for Recipe for Peace Now, no, the purpose for this entire exercise, the purpose that we're sitting in the same room together is that we are trying to get diverse and, dare I say it, maybe adverse groups to reach accord. You don't have to be friends, but you have to be able to work together. You've got a common goal that you need to achieve. You've got a common good that you want to come true. If you start throwing people out because they disagree, wow, you're not going to have too many people. The only people left in the room are going to be, well, I suppose it'll be a nice party, but the only people left in the room are going to be on your side. There's not going to be any 2, 4, 6, how many different divergent issues, how many different divergent opinions there are. So all opinions are, for heaven's sakes, welcome. In fact, it's good to clear the air. It's just that we need to do it in a civil manner. I know that you hear me say that a lot. A lot of you have come to my seminars. A lot of you have, of course, read the book, and a lot of you are practicing what Recipe for Peace Now does. And the idea is really, ultimately, civil discourse. That's the idea. And we've come to be civil. Really, honestly, we have. And sometimes, in the heat of the moment, people get a wee bit excited. So you're going to enforce the rules of order, so to speak. Yes? Yes. And I see that I have several emails here. Thank you, by the way, for all these emails. I have several suggestions, and they all center around the idea of rules of order for a meeting. Yes? The rules of order that say that people, essentially speaking, take turns when they speak. That will help with the excited discussion. And I love this. I have about 4 emails that use the word indoor voice. Remember that from school. You're supposed to use your indoor voice. And this is absolutely true. You're supposed to use your indoor voice when discussing anything in a civil gathering. And you might actually use that. It makes people laugh. Because everybody remembers that from their childhood when they were told to use their indoor voice. And if people are taking turns speaking, then you won't have an angered give and take. You see, I have, depending on the group, and I see this, in fact, I haven't done it in a little while, but I'm reminded of it because someone has mentioned it. Thank you very much, Jason. That's a very good idea, that you can use a timer to make sure that people do not drone on and on and on when they're taking their turn. A timer, something that everyone can see and dings. You can use a stopwatch, but then only you have it in your hand, and a timer is more visual. So that's a good idea too. Yes, we haven't done it in a while, but a timer is a very good idea, especially if somebody has a tendency to make a rather, well, long-winded, I suppose, is unfair, but a rather complex speech. They wish to promote their side, and, well, they figure if they talk long enough, nobody else will get a turn. Yes. So we've got peer pressure. We've got taking our turn. I will tell you that sometimes you need to have a group timeout. Yes, that goes. Somebody's just written that goes with the indoor voice, doesn't it? Yes, that does go with the indoor voice concept. This is absolutely true. It's kind of like, well, yes, we're going to act like tantrumy 2-year-olds. We're going to be treated like them. Sometimes you need a group timeout. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where the food comes in. Yes. We don't have to always sit around in a circle and kind of stare at each other, for heaven's sakes. That's why we've got food. That's why there's a potluck. That's why we talk about recipes on this show. The food is a wonderful way to have a time out. When you see, I know that this takes a little bit of experience, and I'm sure that a lot of you have experience. And because I see from the emails that you've done this before, as they say, and you're dealing with groups right now, the reason we really use the food is it keeps the meeting cordial. It keeps the meeting civil. It's hard to be really nasty when you're eating a delicious casserole. No, but the idea is it gives you something else to do, to talk about, besides what stands between you. It's not really a dining event in that sense. The real reason is because the food is a nice interlude. You could start passing something around. You could ask someone from different sides is an ugly word, but from different opinions to help you. To help you pass things out, to help you serve things, to help you bring things to the table. Let's all have coffee. Let's all have this delicious, whatever it is, this delicious casserole. Let's all have dessert. A lot of times I, as the host, oftentimes bring a dessert just so I'm certain that there is one. Something that's easy to manage, like cake, an unfrosted cake, so that you can cut it into slices and put it really on a paper napkin and or little paper plate or whatever you've got, and not have it too complicated and not need too many forks and things. And then people don't say, "Well, I don't eat dessert because it's more like a bundt cake, more like a coffee cake, a bread in its way." So anyway, that's a good group timeout. You don't have to all go stand in a corner to have a timeout. Somebody said, "Are we going to send them all to corners? Do you have a big enough room?" No, what I meant was that we're going to have a timeout from this line of discussion, and we'll get back to it. Not that we're all going to sit in the corner on a stool with a dunce cap on our head. Also, quite sometimes you kind of feel that you'd like to, but no, you are the host, and you've got to control that urge. And we're not going to do a thing like that. Really, we're not. Okay. And, yes, I see that I've gotten several emails that tell me that if you've got a really – people have suggested – thank you, Jason, and everyone else, and Cheryl. People have suggested that if you know that the group has a tendency towards – we'll call it excited behavior, that it might be best to hold your meetings in a more public place than in somebody's house or somebody's office. And I have actually done that. This is a really good idea. If you find that people have a tendency towards rejecting the process because they are just excitable, and you know that that's a pretty good, it's pretty certain that that's going to happen, that you can hold your meeting in a more public place. I actually do not tend to like a place with like a service restaurant where you all are sitting at a table. You can't really see the other people at the other end of the table, depending how many of you there are. And you can't really walk around and communicate. You have to kind of stay in your place. And you also have a serving person who really would like you not to spend all night at their table, because for goodness sakes, they're working for tips and they need to move. I mean, they need to have people move off the table. So I tend not to do that, but there are many places, restaurants, places that you can rent out for a very small amount of money, or even not charge you for the room if you buy food, which is the chip into the pot theory, that will give you a kind of a private room, a small room, a medium-sized room even. Well, we hope you don't need a big room. That's an awfully big group. But that you can have for a set period of time, and that will allow you to wander around. But it will still be a public place, and you can't get really nasty in a public place because, yes. I have a suggestion from Esteban, which is probably very practical in some circumstances, although I have never actually done it, and I guess it depends on your group. But it's a very practical suggestion. Thank you very much. And he has suggested that if you know that your group is a wee bit likely, as Aaron's group seems to be, to get verbally or physically abusive, that you might have an off-duty uniformed police officer as your, well, as your co-mediator, I might guess you might call him or her, that you might have someone who is there. It is true that in the United States, and I'm sure that other places too, because I know that this program is global, but it is true that a lot of times police officials and police officers who have really, they've got a gun, who have the power to really be persuasive and keep people from becoming, well, especially physically abusive, but even verbally, it leads perhaps to bad things. Police officers do indeed, in their off time, they are allowed to come in full uniform as police officers and get paid to be, for lack of a better word, private security. This is a rather expensive proposition. So, and your group has to warrant it. It is. Yes, I see several. Okay, I have several people who have asked if this has a chilling effect on the proceedings. Because, of course, you have someone who's not involved and is, well, just by the nature of the thing. They don't mean to be judgmental, but, I mean, they're standing there, they're listening, and like that. And I've had about half a dozen emails, and now I've gotten some that agree that say that that will have a chilling effect on the proceedings. Well, I think that you would not have the thought of having a police officer in attendance and the expense of having a police officer in attendance if you didn't think you kind of needed it. And if you really think you need it, I suppose it does have a chilling effect, but it might be overshadowed by the keep everyone civil effect. Hopefully you wouldn't need the officer more than a few times. I mean, this is an ongoing process, And once we reach some sort of civil accord and we can now talk to each other, you wouldn't always need the police officer or the law official to stand there. But I suppose it is the point. I mean, I must tell you that I once lived in a city where there was an actual regulation, an actual law, that if you had a group of more than 50 people getting together, which encompassed weddings and birthday parties and things like that, you were required to have an off-duty police officer in attendance. It wasn't an option. You were required to do that because there was drinking involved, and it was the experience of the municipality that you should have such a thing. So, and I imagine that's a lot of places too, but you won't have a group that big. I have had several questions on how you would go about hiring an off-duty police officer. Esteban, could you please, I assume you're still listening, could you please tell me how to do that? I actually don't know. I've never done it. I have, in my rather long career, I've been doing this for a really long time. I've been since 1982. That's a long time. I have had to have security called because of verbal escalation. I've never actually had a group reach physical violence, but, you know, one thing does lead to another. And those kinds of groups I usually try to have in offices or in public places, as we just discussed, where some sort of security can come in and say you need to keep it down, essentially speaking, because you are disturbing the other patrons, the other surrounding offices. You know what I mean. They kind of come. They're not exactly standing there the whole time, but they get called in as a third party who might, I suppose, as a threat, an implied threat, call a police officer. Thank you, Esteban. Thank you for replying. He says that his brother is a police officer, so he doesn't actually need to hire somebody, which is wonderful. And if you've got someone who'll come for free, no. If you don't really need it, they probably shouldn't even come for free. But he says that you can call the police association or the police headquarters and inquire how it works and how you would find somebody at a certain time and how much it would cost and like that. So the answer is call your police department so that you'll be able to find that out, and then we'll know. Alrighty, so yes, and security is an interesting thing because they have an implied threat. The police officer, you know, if you really think you need it, and you might even ask all sides if they approve of that, because they're probably going to have to chip in some money. I assume that an actual police officer in uniform is a rather expensive person to hire. I mean, they're going to have to stand there for quite a while. But, you know, they have to be present for quite a while. And, you'd have to think about that. It adds a different... Yeah, I have an email here. I have a comment here that says that it will add an escalation. Thank you, Joseph. He says it will add an escalation to the dissension after the police officer is no longer in attendance, like when we're no longer in a meeting, we're no longer in a group, but it will change the tenor, of the meeting. It will change the tenor of the consensus to be reached. So thank you, Esteban. It's an interesting idea. I think, personally, because I guess I have the luxury of not dealing with groups that need it, in my opinion, I would think that wouldn't be a first resort. I would think that would be a last resort, just because of the chilling effect and the assumption that you need the police officer there because the group will become unruly, shall we say. We're going to try to keep them ruly. We're going to feed them. Yes, and which is an excellent segue into what I swear is the most favorite part of these programs, because I get all kinds of people who send me emails saying, and they send me wonderful recipes, and they tell me how much they enjoy that part. So it's like, well, yes, the advice is good. I'm glad that we're answering all these questions, but let's get to the food. And so, but as a closing, before we do the recipes, I want to thank everybody very much for sending in the questions and for making the comments. Thank you. That's just wonderful, because I always learn something too when we do one of these episodes, when we do one of these shows. I learn something too. And because all of us, I think, get kind of into a routine of what we do, and we deal with similar types of groups within our own spheres. So it's very interesting to see other ideas and to hear questions about what we should do. And see, I always learn something, and I find it very interesting, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very much for everybody who's participated. And yes, I have several people sending in wonderful recipes, because we've hit the recipe part. They sound magnificent. I will copy them down. I will print them out. We will try them. I will think about them. I will drool, but I've kind of got two that I have prepared for today's show. And so I'm, with your permission, we're going to go on to that. And these recipes sound wonderful, but we'll do them in a different show. Thank you very, very much. And so now we're going to go on to the potluck recipe portion of our show, because, well, food is, you hear me say this all the time, but food's a really good way to get people talking, to get people feeling convivial, to make everyone comfortable, and to prevent an unpleasant meeting. To get everyone to think, well, I think that we can come to some accord. We can reach a common goal. And yes, I know that everyone has heard me say this 1,000 times, but some people are new to the show, and some people have never, you know, seen any of the Recipe for Peace Now seminars or anything like that. So I know you've said it 1,000 times, but I'm going to do it again. When you have people who are bringing food, and even if you are in a, as we discussed, a public place that is serving food, that is in a buffet style, that you don't actually have each person order, which would be very clumsy. So you want to have it more like a potluck, really. More food that is available to go up and back to, and not something that you have to sit with a plate that someone has served you. It needs to be labeled. Please, 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 please. Whenever you're sharing food, whenever you have any kind of food that is being shared, you need to have a label of all the ingredients on an index card or something in front of every dish. In fact, you will indeed ask everyone before they bring food, or ask the restaurant or the establishment where the food is coming from, to do this, and not just say what it is. I am very, very big on this, and it's very important, because sometimes people are allergic, and you don't want someone to get sick and they are allergic to an ingredient. I have a dear friend who is allergic to vinegar, really allergic to it, and that's a con- condiment practically. It's something that is mixed in. She's allergic to all any kind of vinegar, even like his balsamic vinegar. But anyway, but she's allergic to that, and it's not a primary in the title of the food type thing. It's an ingredient. So no cheating. If you've got fish sauce, you put fish sauce down. And it's very, very important because not only don't you want anybody to get sick from an allergic reaction, but sometimes people have a dietary restriction. They're on some sort of a diet that they need to not eat something, and they will get rather distraught if they accidentally eat it. And sometimes people have a religious prohibition or I'm going to call it a moral prohibition. It may not be a mainstream religious prohibition, but they just don't eat something. And you don't want them to be offended or panicky or anything. You want everyone to have a positive experience. So please, please, please label and make sure that everybody knows what it is. Also, when you are confirming the meetings, and I know that you've heard me say this too, but ask in advance if anybody truly has a dietary restriction, allergic reaction, or something else that they just can't eat. Now, this is fairly common. A lot of people have all kinds of things that they cannot eat. And sometimes there is a religious reason that has not as much to do with the food as with its preparation. Now, for example, a lot of times people have a not mixing of different kinds of foods prohibition. So, for example, if you're very, very kosher, you keep everything separate within your kitchen. It's a process prohibition. You got to know these kinds of things. And if someone truly has a dietary restriction, you will ask them, I know you've heard me say this before, those of you who have heard this speech, but some of you haven't, you will ask them in the email where you ask this when you are confirming or on the phone, you will ask them about the dietary restrictions. You will try to accommodate them. If it is something they can't be in the same room with, like peanuts, and they're really terribly allergic, you'll have to tell the other people, and they will have to not bring something with that ingredient. But if somebody truly has a dietary or religious restriction, you will have them bring their own dish with enough to share if they can't share with other people. You know, they can't eat other people's dishes. They want to share, but they will come prepared not to share other people's dishes because you can't have people process in a certain way and like that. Okay, so now you've heard my little speech that I always make about you don't let anybody get sick or offended. And you will also remember that as the host, it is your responsibility to ask in advance. Tell everybody in advance, this is where reply all comes in, I suppose. And as the host, it is your responsibility to supply some safe choices so that everybody has something that they can eat. Yes, I usually have food left over, but that's just me. So we're going to have our recipe now. Yay! And the first one that we're going to talk about is the safe choice. What does that mean? I know that I say that, but I define it a lot, but I haven't defined it this time. A safe choice, in my opinion, is a recipe, a food to share that most people can eat, that hopefully everyone in the group can eat because you have asked about allergic reactions and you have asked about what dietary restrictions and like that. So you know pretty much, but you never know. You might have someone come to the group. It's not an invitation-only thing, any of these groups. People can come. People can bring someone else. It's not one of those, only those who are on the email list can come, unless you have restricted it in some way, like an executive board. But generally speaking, you never know. So we're going to have a safe dish that is supplied by the host. This will be something that is not too spicy and is not something that people are generally allergic to, and that most people, no matter what their preference for types of food, that most people will find good, that they'll find it delicious and will not like it. So this is the safe recipe. It does, of course, have dairy. We will, of course, label what is in it. But in addition to having dairy, it is fairly obvious what it is. There's not a real big surprise. That's my other kind of rule for a safe dish. I think if it's going to be a big surprise, maybe you shouldn't do it. But not, at least not in your safe dish. You can have an adventure dish, too. We're going to have the next one's an adventure dish, and it's wonderful. And it's got a lot of different kinds of spices and ingredients and a lot of potential for not being a safe dish, I'm afraid. So we're going to do a potato cheese bake as our safe dish. And first of all, we're going to preheat the oven to about 325. Because if I don't say preheat first, how will you know to preheat? And then these are going to be the ingredients, if you would like to write them down. We're going to have a nice thick pat of butter. In fact, with maybe a couple of them. We're going to have two onions, which we're going to thinly slice. Aren't those food processor machines wonderful for things like that? We're going to have 3 pounds of potatoes that we're going to skin. We're going to peel. You don't skin potatoes, you peel potatoes. Right. We're going to have 3 pounds of peeled potatoes, which we're also going to thinly slice. And we're going to have 1.5 cups of grated cheddar cheese. And then we're going to have another 1/2 cup of the grated cheddar cheese that we're going to reserve for the top of the cheese bake. So it's really 2 cups of cheese, but we're going to reserve 1/2 cup for later. We're going to have a whole little carton of cream. Yes, I know it's fattening, but it's so delicious. And we're going to have about 6 ounces of milk. And you, of course, will eyeball it and see if it's too much liquid or too little liquid, right? Right. So we're going to heat up a frying pan, and we're going to put the pat of butter in it. And we're going to add the onions. And we're going to cook it over a low heat for about 5 minutes, until the onions get soft and what they call translucent, until they get nice and juicy and edible. And then we're going to take did I mention that we grease the pan? Oh, did I mention that? No. That we're going to have a pan that will hold about 8 nice little servings of this. Depending on how people eat, it will be more than that if everybody just takes a big spoonful. But we're going to get a rectangular, it could be a square. I have a rectangular pan. But we're going to take an oven-proof pan, and we're going to grease it around. And then we're going to take our potato slices and layer that with the onions and the cheese up and back and up and back. We're just going to make layers, potato on the bottom, and then I usually put the onions and the cheese and then the potato again. You know what I mean, make layers. And then we're going to take our liquid, our cream and our milk, we're going to whisk them together. We're going to put maybe some salt and pepper. Depending on who you've got coming and if you know their tastes, you could do something a little more spicy, a dash of Tabasco or something. This is my safe dish. I don't do anything imaginative with it. I just make it straight out, and it's delicious, and most people really like it. And if you really think it's bland, you can always, I have salt and condiments and stuff on the counter, you can add to it. So we're going to take the liquid, and we're going to gently pour it all over our potatoes and cheese and onion layers so that we don't disturb the layers. We're not just going to plop it in. We're going to, well, drizzle's a big word, not really drizzle, but you know what I mean. We're going to pour it slowly over the mixture so that it's everywhere. And then we're going to take our half cup of cheese, because I like it nice and cheesy, and we're going to sprinkle that all over the top so that we've got one of those bubbly brown tops. Yes, yes. Oh, yum, yum. And we're going to bake this for about an hour. Ovens vary, as they say, but an hour should pretty much do it. And then we're going to, before we really take it and cut it, well, the key to cooking it, really, I should say this, is that you cook it until the potatoes are nice and soft and it's got a bubbly brown top to it. How do you know if the potatoes are soft? It is, you poke them. Now, somebody says with a toothpick. Now, that's, thank you, Cheryl, that is a good point about poking it with a toothpick. I think I'm clumsy. I swear. I usually burn myself when I poke something with a toothpick. And so I usually use a thin pronged fork type serving item and give it and poke it down and make sure that everything's soft and proper, because then I don't burn my hand. But a toothpick would work if you have less sensitive fingers than I do. I don't know. Maybe you have long toothpicks. I get their short toothpicks, and it just doesn't work for me. Someone says a skewer. Good point. A skewer is a long toothpick, and therefore we will say test it with a skewer. Yes. But anyway, the potatoes are supposed to be soft, and the top's supposed to be brown and bubbly. If you let it stand after it has cooked, first of all, it's beastly hot, and you can't just surf it. People will burn their mouths. But if you let it stand for about 15 minutes, maybe longer would be okay too, when you go to cut it, it will not make a square, really. This is not a pudding. But it will make a more solid presentation on the plate and a more solid presentation to eat. It'll look better, and it will have, the ingredients will have melded together better. So I think that you should let it stand before you take a utensil to it and start cutting it up and putting a spoon in it and like that. So that is our basically safe recipe. And we are going to label it, of course. We're going to say all the ingredients that we put in, including any kind of an added condiment that you decided this is very bland and you're going to put Tabasco sauce in it or something. And we're going to put that out. Most people can eat this. It is basically vegetarian, not vegan, but vegetarian. And I know for sure what is in it. You've heard me say this before, and I don't really give a recipe for it because that's up to you, and you can even store by this. But I usually also have some sort of a cake, a plain cake, also on the table so that people can have a slice of cake whenever they want it. I find that that's very pleasant. All right. Now, we have talked about my safe recipe. It was easy to do. You could even bake it in advance and rewarm it. You could refrigerate it. It will not hurt it a bit. Pardon me. It will not hurt it a bit because it actually makes it come together even better. Of course, I disapprove of doing it too much in advance because I'm afraid that it might turn funny, as they say. And did I mention you don't want to make anyone sick? Yes, I bet I did. Okay, now I have promised my adventure recipe. And my adventure recipe is going to be chicken curry. But it's not the kind of chicken curry that's a stew. It's more like coated pieces of chicken with a marvelous curry topping. My dear friend Padmea sent me this recipe, and I've tried it, and it's just yummy. It does have a lot of ingredients, and it is an adventurous recipe, and people just love it. It's very different, and it's just delicious. And you can also make the curry paste for this like the day before and put it in the refrigerator. And so it's something that you can make a smidge before, because if you're like me, you're always kind of running late. Okay, so this is going to be a chicken curry where we coat the chicken, and it's not a stew like you think of as a curry. So here are the ingredients. It's basically a pan dish, although, yeah, it really is. It's basically a pan dish, so we're not particularly going to preheat an oven. All righty. We're going to have 2 cups of that lovely unsweetened shredded coconut that comes in the bags. It's like a dry coconut. It's very nice, and I don't know how to do fresh coconut. If you know how to do such a thing and you have access, I'm sure that would be charming. But don't get the sugary kind, unless you really like a sugary taste. Come to think of it, you can do as you please. But I usually, okay, I've been told to use the unsweetened dry coconut. And that's all I've used, so I assume sugar would be okay, but it's a little different consistency. And we're going to have about 3-4 tablespoons of vegetable oil. And we're going to have 1 teaspoon of cumin seeds. We're going to have some peppercorns. We're going to have 4 black peppercorns. We're going to have 1 tablespoon of fennel seeds. And we're going to have 1 tablespoon of coriander seeds. Look at all the nice spices that are in that. We're going to remember to label this, right? Right, of course we are. I knew that. And then we're going to have 3 onions that we're going to finely chop. And we're going to have a pinch of salt, because we always put in a pinch of salt. This will make, depending on the size and how much coating you like, I think it'll make 12 to 15 drumsticks. So if you've got more people than that, or you figure, I figure a couple drumsticks per person, that's, seems to be, because some people don't and some people take more. I like to have spares. So this recipe, 15 tops, 12 if they're really big, and depending on how much coating you like on stuff. But I think 12 to 15 drumsticks. Do skin them, please. I'm thinking about it, I'm going, well, of course you need to skin them. And so what are we going to do? The first thing we're going to do is we're going to take that lovely dry coconut, and we're going to soak it in a little bit of water, like maybe 4 tablespoons of water. And we're going to soak it for about 15 minutes because you got to get it soft. You're not going to use it in its dry state because it just won't work. You got to get it soft. And we're going to take the oil, and we're going to take about half of it and throw it into a large skillet, a large pan. I suppose you could use a wok or some sort of a thing, but something that will hold all of this. And we're going to fry the cumin seeds, the peppercorns, the fennel, the coriander over a low heat for about 5 minutes. I figure you do it until the whole thing starts to kind of pop and move around in the pan. So you do it until that happens. I've been informed that, yes, thank you. The word for that is splutter. I hope that's the word for that. I've never heard the word splutter before. Good. If that is the official word, yes. Until they're done. No, until they start to move around. And splutter. I like splutter. Thank you. Thank you, Cheryl. That's a lovely word. It's so descriptive. And then you're going to the same pan where you now have the spluttering seeds. And all kinds of spices. You're going to add your finely chopped onion, and you're going to fry that for about 5 minutes because it'll keep them spluttering. I just love that word. But you're going to fry that for about 5 minutes, also until it gets nice and soft and translucent in appearance. You're going to stir it around so that you don't get anything stuck to the pan, and so it comes out real nice. Now, after you've done that, you're going to stir in our lovely drained coconut, and you might even put the couple tablespoons of water in, depending on how the mixture looks and if it needs a little bit of moisture. I usually do. The recipe that was given to me said to drain the coconut. I kind of personally find that you can use the couple tablespoons of water, but that's just me. You will look at it and see if you think so, because That's up to you as you're cooking it. I think it could use the little bit extra, though. And you might as well use the water that came off the coconut because it has a delicious taste. And you're going to throw the pinch of salt in, of course. And we're going to take this and fry it and stir it around and like that to prevent it from sticking for about, well, 5 more minutes till everything looks nicely put together. Till everything, oh, Cheryl has sent me another good word. Till everything incorporates. Ha! I'm going to have to remember splitter and incorporate now. So, we now have our lovely mixture. And it's not something that you can put on the chicken, right? It is not smooth. So, we're going to take this whole thing out of the pan. And we're going to put it in a blender. And we're going to process it into a paste, kind of a coarse paste, not a puree, not make it. We'd like it to have some texture to it, but the onions and the coconut and like that have not melded into something that you can use on your chicken, right? Right. So we're going to make it into a coarse paste. Yes. And now we're going to just leave in the food processor for a minute. Because we are going to think about our chicken now that we've got the chicken topping. So we're going to take the remaining oil, which is, what, a couple of tablespoons, and fry the chicken for about 10 minutes. You want to make it all, you need to turn them around, of course, and you need to cook them, well, 10 minutes. The chicken will cook basically through and get a little bit browned on the outside and like that, maybe a little more than 10 minutes. And now we're going to take our lovely, we're going to call it our curry coconut paste, and we're going to put it on the chickens, right, in the pot. And we're going to cook the whole thing over low heat for about 20, 25 minutes until the coconut mixture, the coconut curry mixture is golden brown and the chicken is nice and soft. And we've coated it, and we've turned the chicken drumsticks around in it so that it's nicely coated and like that, and it will just be yummy. And you can serve a steamed rice next to it. You can put it on the steamed rice if you would like. That will make the juice kind of go into the rice, which is very nice too. I actually like to serve this just on a platter. In fact, as you can probably figure out, I tend to make a double portion of a double recipe because I like to have plenty of food, and it's quite popular, and drumsticks are lovely to eat and easy to handle. We do have napkins, I want you to know that. But there's not that much meat on them, and I don't like people to feel that. I don't like to run out, okay? And it's perfectly delicious the next day cold for lunch. But I like to put the chicken drumsticks on a platter by themselves. And then if you have a rice steamer, you can use the rice steamer, of course, for a whole bunch of rice. And if not, you can make rice and just put it in a separate big bowl next to it with a spoon. And people can take the rice separate. I suppose I like to keep everything separate because I tend to use the leftovers. And if there's rice stuck to the drumsticks, it's not quite as cool. So that's your adventure recipe for today. That is not the safe recipe because it has, well, it's kind of spicy and it has a lot of things in it. And so it's not quite as safe as it could be. But it is delicious. It is group friendly. And everybody will go, what is that? What's in it? Look, we've already started talking. Yay! And they will say the same thing about the potato cheese bake. How did you make that? And you can confess that that's really easy to make. And you've probably got all the ingredients right in your house as we speak. And it will be lovely. It will get people to come together. It will get them talking about something that they don't dislike or aren't fighting about. Because they will be having already a consensus-building event. We're going to start with the consensus that we can be civil, and we're going to work from there. Yes, yes. You can positively do it. It will all work out. I I could guarantee it, but you know that it's going to work out. Consensus can be reached with every different group. Thank you very much for all of your questions. Thank you very much for all of your comments and your suggestions. Thank you very much for the recipes that came in. I've gotten several of them now. I'm excited, and we're going to be testing them out. And I'm sure they're absolutely wonderful. And thank you very much for listening. I hope you come again. If you would like to ask a question, make a comment in advance or during one of the programs, these are done live, you can contact me at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com, or you can go to the website. There is a contact page at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope to hear from you again. Bye-bye.